So I did an interview. It was with Alyssa Wald, the author of The Secret Lives of Married Women. She happened to be coming through New York. I met her. And what happened was something quite extraordinary, something unprecedented in Bat Segundo history. I had a lot of assumptions about how she wrote the book, how she read the book, where she drew her inspiration from. And just about every one of these assumptions was absolutely wrong. And this being a noir book, I kept things fairly simple and said, well, have you read any noir? It turned out that she had not. And this caused something strange to explode in my head, which, as you will soon hear in the following conversation, caused me to stop the interview, caused me to actually incriminate myself and condemn myself and go through a kind of strange minor neurosis. Okay, so I am here with Alyssa Wald, who is most recently the author of The Secret Lives of Married Women. Alyssa, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It intoxicates me to be in New York.
It does. How does it intoxicate you? Like liquor? Like drugs? Like something a little bit more less pernicious?
I used to live here. I lived here for 18 years.
Yes.
And, in the last 7 years, this is only my second time here.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels so good. It feels like home to me still.
So you lived here for 18 years.
I lived here for 18 years. And I love Portland. I live in Portland now.
You switched the subject. And I love Portland. So well, those 18 years were terribly good?
Nothing against Portland. I love Portland. But New York still feels like home to me.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this book. I wanted to start off through a very unusual angle. I wanted to bring up Norman Mailer's review of American Psycho in Vanity Fair in 1991. He was one of the first figures to defend that book, and he wrote, "Nowhere in American literature can one point to an inhumanity of the moneyed upon the afflicted equal to the following description," and he proceeded to describe Patrick Bateman's assault on the bum. Mailer also tied this in, of course, with Hannah Arendt's notion of the banality of evil, but, you know, this is all very much in line with the first novella in your book, The Man Under the House, because the treatment that Stoss offers this laborer Jack hits many of the same notes. And it got me thinking, wow, we really don't have this idea in fiction these days. And I wanted to ask, I mean, in the last 22 years, why do you think American literature has not been especially concerned with this notion of class violence? To what degree were you aware of it, and did you hope to respond to it in any way?
Well, before we get to that, could you clarify what you mean by Stoss's treatment of the...
Of Jack?
Yes.
Well, in the sense that there seems to be this kind of strange resentment, not just in relation to obviously his wife, Lena, but also in relation to just, you know, he kind of resents the guy. There's this moment where he is humiliated in Home Depot. So I picked up on this kind of class resentment that dictates Stoss. And we could talk about how also it informs his past from Russia, because he was indeed a handyman in his early days, as we learn in New York. But that notion of violence with this kind of class-to-class idea attached to it was something that actually really was different, and what I don't usually see in fiction, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk with you. One of the reasons I wanted to get your answer on the subject.
That's a fascinating question, and I haven't thought about it. I actually would not have thought about it that way at all. I don't think Stoss is drawing a distinction between himself and the workman on a class level. I think he just felt like this man is overly interested in my wife. I think he noticed that before the wife did, and that was what he was reacting to.
Yeah. Even though we have this move from New York to Portland suburbia, where there's the grand announcement, hey, I have a backyard, and all this. So none of that was really actually a concern of yours, or were you playing with some of the ideas of middle class strivings or anything like that? Were you thinking about any of this in any way?
Not consciously, no. I mean, I can't. You know, people bring all kinds of interpretations to your work, and you know, I never will say, "Oh, that's not what it's about," because I don't know. You know, I can only say it's not consciously what it's about. It was nowhere in my mind.
Class was never a factor at all?
It wasn't.
Wow.
Never crossed my mind.
What do you think, now that I've rambled quite a bit about it, you know, I mean, why do you think that I got this particular reaction from it? I mean, what do you think, why were you any concerned with any kind of socioeconomics at all? Or?
Well, I guess the one place where I can see what you're saying maybe is there's a moment when Jack is literally under the house.
Yeah.
He's looking at the pipes. And she has this, she flashes on this picture of this kind of, yeah, proletariat, yeah, bristling.
Yes.
And so, yes, I guess I did say a member of the underworld bent on mutiny.
Yeah.
So, yes, so this is what I mean. I'm not dismissing your interpretation.
No, no, no.
Just saying that I wasn't consciously aware of it for much of the book.
Well, what interested you about exploring this dynamic between with Jack and with Stas? Well, I mean, what kept the conflict brewing as you were writing this?
Well, so interestingly, my husband and I did buy a house.
Uh-huh.
There was a very attentive worker next door, and I spun the story into something so much more dramatic and involved than anything that really happened. But something that did happen early on was my husband really didn't like this guy right away, and I thought he was overreacting at first. And by the time I started to feel like this guy was very overbearing, I didn't want to tell my husband. And there were a few reasons for that. But one of them was I thought, if I tell him, then there's going to be a war. There's going to be a war on some level. We just moved into this house. This guy is right next door. He's essentially a neighbor for the time being. I don't want an open war with this person. We just moved in. I don't want this around my home. So I think most writers are, to an extent, a participant slash observer in their own lives. So they're living their lives, and they're very much a participant. But there's also, I think, a part of the writer's mind that's always observing.
Yeah.
And so I thought, isn't this interesting? I'm not only, you know, becoming nervous about this man, but I feel like he's driving an emotional wedge between my husband and myself. And that's that was fascinating. Even while it was wildly uncomfortable to experience it, it was still fascinating to the writer in me. And so I just took it from there and spun it.
Your husband is in Russian by chance.
He is.
He is?
Yes.
My goodness. So you were really drawing from reality.
So like a lot of writers,
yeah.
You know, I know a lot of writers even give their protagonists their own names, but it's still fiction, you know, like Philip Roth does this,
sure,
a lot. So I really do draw tremendously from life a lot of the time, and yet it's unequivocally fiction. I make all kinds of stuff up.
Yeah.
So there's really a blur.
Do you have any legal background at all? Or?
No. Only I did work for an attorney. But just as an assistant.
Was he blind?
No, I did work for a blind man.
Oh, okay.
But he wasn't a lawyer. Huh.
So the first part, interestingly enough, is truer to your life than the second part.
You know, I think everything's true to my life on some level.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I identify with all the characters on some level.
Yeah.
All the female characters.
Sure. In the New York Times book review, I wanted to bring up Megan Abbott's review. She wrote about your book, and she brought up James M. Cain's notion of the love rack, which involves finding a way to manipulate the readers into caring for criminal figures. The way into that, she said, was often through lust or desire. That's how you get that kind of vicarious solicitude for a scumbag. I'm wondering, to what degree was the idea of planting Lita in this sort of suburban splendor, or Lillian in this seemingly stable world vocationally as an attorney, was kind of your 21st century answer to the love rack? I mean, was one of your goals to reach these kinds of vanilla middle-class readers or anything? Or?
You know, interesting. So we talked a moment ago about how people bring their own interpretations. It was very amusing to me that, I mean, Megan Abbott is a phenomenal,
yes,
writer. I appreciated her review very deeply. But she imagined that it was a deep, deliberate bow to legendary noir author James M. Cain, and I've never read a word of Cain in my entire life.
You have not?
Never. Not once. Never seen a film based on any of his books. Never given him a moment's thought.
My goodness.
So that was interesting to me that she decided that.
Well, I apparently have done the same thing. My goodness.
Have you read any books? But actually, you know, I think it's great that people bring their own interpretations. To me, that means it's speaking directly to a reader's experience and their frame of reference. And, you know, so I don't mind. I don't mind that people do that.
But I agree with Megan to a large degree, because it does fulfill some of the relationship that books have to noir while simultaneously also breaking from them. And you know, this leads me to ask you, I mean, what kind of criminal fiction or noir have you soaked up? Or are you just basically living a noir life and that's where it comes from?
I've read almost no noir in my entire life. This is a
wow,
brand new genre for me. I didn't set out to write a crime novel. What happened was that Charles R. Dye is a longtime friend of mine.
Yeah.
Charles R. Dye, the publisher of
Hard
Case Crime. And I have sent him everything I've written for the last 25 years because he's a great reader. He's a great editor.
Yes, yes.
And it never occurred to me ever that I would ever be a hard case author because I don't write crime fiction. So I sent him The Man Under the House.
Now?
And it's been wonderful. But I sent him The Man Under the House. It was just a long story.
Yeah.
And to my and I was aware I was trying my hand at a psychological thriller, but it honestly hadn't crossed my mind that it was also a crime story. Just hadn't thought of it in that way. So I was astonished when he said, I want this for hard case. But no, this isn't my genre. It's never been my genre. I've read no crime writers. Scott Turow is the one thriller writer that I've read and loved.
Wow. So this is amazing to me because, I mean, you're an accidental genre writer in this case. But you know, I'm still curious where this kind of noir subconscious sense came from. I mean, it may very well be a futile question, but I'm wondering, you know, what kind of influence or life experience brings you to think like this and to feel like this?
It's funny you say that because, so Charles, I said, what do you mean you want this for hard case? It's not a book.
Yeah.
It's just 96 pages. He said, well, we'd have to expand it in some way. He didn't want me to pad a 96-page piece with unnecessary material, so we explored the idea of writing a second story that felt linked to the first, naturally. And I had this material that I had for a long time wanted to do something with, and I didn't know what. And it involved the blind boss, a professional submissive, a Carmelite convent. And just in regular literary fiction, this would be so over the top.
Yeah.
You know, like these elements would be so over the top. But it was perfect for noir. It was just absolutely perfect. It was as if this vehicle had just come. It was just an incredibly serendipitous thing. And it liberated me to write this noirish story.
Well, if you had no noir experience, how did you get to know Charles? That's what I want to know.
I just met him in college.
Really?
Yeah, we were both writers at Columbia, and we were in the writers' club together. There was a writers' club.
This is probably one of the most hilarious Segunda conversations I've actually had in a while, because normally there's just some kind of like, yes, well, I happen to read this, but I'm getting nothing here in terms of like influence. I mean, no influence whatsoever. I mean,
from whom?
From books or from life?
Oh,
or
of course, I've been very influenced by all kinds of writers, just not noir authors. I mean, Alice Munro is my favorite writer of all time. And one thing
the Nobel Committee would agree with you.
Yes, and I was thrilled about that. But one thing Alice Munro does is she has really, she's made the short story an art form in a way that I believe no other person ever has. And she writes these long, long, long short stories that are essentially novellas, and she flashes backward and forward. She will work a lifetime of material into a short piece. And you can think it's about one thing and the story will do this hairpin turn and be about something else and be about something else. And so if there's anyone that I've tried to absorb with all my might and emulate, it would be her.
Yeah. You know, you're almost the independent variable in this ongoing dialectic between literary versus genre, which I refuse to acknowledge because I like both.
I love that.
And this basically illustrates that when you think in terms of twists and turns, it doesn't matter whether it comes from Alice Munro or James Cain. It's going to be there if you actually just are attuned to rhythm and attuned to the way that narrative wends its way to a resolution. I think we can safely say that. So Alice Munro, who else, out of curiosity?
Oh, who else do I love?
Yeah, who else did you get this kind of the notion for twists down, or have you just had a lot of crazy turns in your own life?
Gee, that's a good question. Authors that sort of utilize twists. I don't. You know, no one's springing immediately to mind for that. Just to go back to something you said about genre versus literary, I mean, I think there are genre writers who are so good that they absolutely transcend the genre. So I mentioned Scott Turow. He writes thrillers, but I believe that it transcends I believe his books transcend the thriller genre, and they're absolutely great books by any definition. And I think Stephen King is the same. Like, he writes horror, but he's such a good writer that he transcends the horror genre.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to do that for erotic fiction. You know, it bothers me that erotic fiction isn't taken seriously by either readers or writers, you know, for the most part. I always wanted to write a book that was very erotic and yet was more, you know, that couldn't just be put in the erotica category of a bookstore.
Huh. So, I mean, in terms of erotic fiction, what stumbling blocks have you had over the course of your writing career?
In terms of what?
Just in terms of difficulties, in terms of trying to actually get more respect for erotica rather than have it be consigned to the sort of, I guess, the equivalent of walking into the part of the video store with the beads in the back, you know?
Right. Well, I do think that there is a ghetto that erotic writers get put into. So my first book, Meeting the Master, is a fiction collection. And to me, it's very erotic, but there's not a lot of graphic sex in there. It's not about whips and chains. It's about the dynamics of domination and submission. And some stores put it in the fiction section, but Borders and a few other stores put it in the erotica section where I, you know, it's not that I minded that it was there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I felt that it belonged in the fiction section as well.
Yeah. So the chains, so to speak, they were the ones who really kind of consigned you to that erotica section. Did you ever get any explanation for them or anything like that as to why your stuff was too hot for them or not willing to stand toe-to-toe with Scott Turow?
Well, who knows if they even read it. Maybe that was the cover. And, yeah. You know, to in their defense, possibly I've had naked girls on almost every book cover I've ever had. And so maybe that was just...
Well, hey, this sells books, right?
Yeah, I think, it's definitely, if it can make someone pick up a book, that's great.
I wanted to talk about the opening of Abel's Cain, where you have Nan. She's reading in front of Abel, this blind attorney. It reminded me, I'm sure you've heard of this website, Hysterical Literature.
I haven't.
You haven't? Okay. Are you familiar with the website Beautiful Agony?
No.
Okay.
But,
yes,
but
it's not like the interviewer reveals how much he looks at sex sites online. Anyways,
there's nothing wrong with looking at sex sites online.
I have no problem with it. I have, you know, it's what every man does. But anyway, so there's this fascinating site called Hysterical Literature, and it has women, including Margaret Cho, oddly enough, who are reading in front of this black and white camera. The camera shoots them from, you know, from the top, and an assistant is actually basically pleasuring them below. And it's an interesting project because they're trying to read this book, and you become absolutely attuned to this relationship they have between mind and body, between body and art, between how we look upon females, and in a weird way kind of implicates the viewer, but it's also, well, it's extremely interesting on a number of visceral and emotional and intellectual ways, which I won't really delve into what it was, but I did want to ask about this.
I am familiar insofar that I've seen a clip of Stoya doing that, and it was
Stoya did, yes.
And it was adorable.
Yes, it was really, really, very, very nice. And actually, you know, the thing about that too is that, you know, the personality of the person really comes across in these clips. But I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, the project implicates the viewer in a way, and I'm wondering with Nan's reading whether you wish to possibly implicate the reader in a kind of dialogue along these lines, or how much you've thought about this in relation to how something that is erotic or non-erotic in some way may in fact actually also have these additional layers. I mean, you know, to what extent have you played with this in your work?
I want to understand exactly what you're asking me. Can you just...
Well, if the reader is blind, just as blind as the attorney, to what non...
He's actually an industrial developer.
Industrial developer. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
The industrial developer is blind very much to Nan's feelings and Nan's motivations. We learn her background as the novella actually unfolds. And I'm wondering, you know, if this was also your way of implicating the sort of the blindness of the reader in any way, and also playing along similar kind of conversations that say the Hysterical Literature project is actually constantly unfolding intermittently through the course of its black and white videos.
I don't know if I would agree that the blind boss is blind to his assistant's feelings. So Nan is kind of an unreliable narrator. You're not quite sure. I think there's supposed to be this ambiguity whether she believes they have an understanding. She believes they have an unspoken understanding, and it's not quite clear whether they do or not.
Yeah.
But I believe they do.
Yeah.
And so I think he's aware of how she feels.
But what are the notion of the sort of sexual underpinning of reading something aloud? I mean, was this one of the ideas behind this?
I mean, is that an erotic act?
Yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on the erotic idea of a woman reading? There's just a really sort of strange thing that the Hysterical Literature project actually sort of brings out as well and actually wants to discuss this notion.
I don't know that I've thought specifically about a woman reading, but having positioned myself under the BDSM fetish umbrella all my life, I mean, it's undeniable, and I've really made a study of everything that I've been able to think about underneath that umbrella. There's lots and lots of people whose erotic gratification does not come from anything that we recognize as sexual. Cleaning someone's home, shining someone's shoes, being whipped, even at a distance of like 6 feet with a single tail. Like, so these people aren't even near each other. There's no...
I like this little specificity. Even at a distance of 6 feet, these things are considerations.
I mean, I have a friend who's a dominant, and her favorite implement is the single tail, and she will say, I'm 6 feet away from this man. And in his mind, we're having an ecstatic sex, and in my mind, we're not having sex at all.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I've been grappling a lot, especially lately, having written Abel's Cain, with the idea of, well, if you have a fetish or if you have something that really thrills your soul and gets you off and it isn't anything we recognize as sex, is it sexual? Is it not sexual? You know, these are really interesting questions. I can't pretend I have unequivocal answers.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, grappling.
Well, what we're talking about here is essentially this idea of intimacy being removed through either a whip or through not being able to see the other person or through, observing from a distance. That's, I think, what we're talking about here.
Do you think intimacy is being removed or possibly removed and enhanced at the same
possibly.
Time?
Possibly. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. Yeah, I'm trying to get your feelings on on this particular subject. No, they're all forms of intimacy. The question is why go ahead and be too literal about it?
In terms of...
Well, in terms of, like, you know, literal intimacy being right next to someone. That's the obvious intimacy. And what we're talking about is exploring intimacy in other ways.
I agree 100%. I think part of the problem is the way we think of sex is so incredibly limited.
Yeah.
Our definition of sex as a culture is so limited. And really, it's much faster than we give it credit for.
Sure. I wanted to bring up the movie Payback in this, because this also sort of gets into this exact same subject. Because in the first part, we are led to believe that it's essentially this kind of relatively harmless soft porn Skinamax movie in the 1980s or 1990s. And in the second part, the movie takes on this more menacing suggestion. I mean, Lillian is actively standing against pornography. And we don't really know too many details from the film or even really what happens. It becomes this kind of curious metric to expose the moral feelings of these various characters. And I'm wondering... it's interesting that it would be sort of a soft porn movie, or depending upon how you define it, a movie of more menacing persuasion. And I'm wondering, you know, how you hit upon that idea of using this almost as a way to reflect the nature of the characters, and why that seemed to be the best way to do it in terms of the moral nature of these characters.
Well, I wanted the wife to have a secret.
Yeah,
and this just seemed like a reasonable secret, and it also dovetailed very nicely with the first story. Like, it was a good vehicle for both stories.
Yeah.
So that was part of the, the draw.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, have you generally thought about movies like this as a way of, people's opinions about a particular movie really reveal morality in a way that, say, removed intimacy or, thoughts on other subjects don't?
You're asking if people's reactions to a movie can reveal their own...
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, why you feel that people's reaction to a movie like this kind of possibly reveals their morality or their feelings about the universe more than actually talking with each other. Is it because we place such a stigma on sex or something along those lines?
I mean, I think our reactions to everything pretty much reflect our moral sensibilities. You know, books, movies, you know, current events.
Yeah.
What's going on in politics... You know, there's lots and lots of different controversial topics, and I feel like the stances people take are really a reflection of their values, obviously.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's talk also about the men that Lita and Lillian are married to. I mean, with Lita, you have Stan, as I said, humiliated in Home Depot, probably the worst place in the world where any man wants to have his blue-collar ass handed to him, right? What's interesting is that Stas is... background. It transforms into this kind of cold, entrepreneurial, exploitative mindset. I mean, he very much becomes the guy who is exploiting the workers. We know also he has this roommate who has this criminal past in Russia. With Lillian, however, we have Darren. I mean, it's a case where...
So you see Stas as having exploited workers?
Well, with the whole building all the computers and all that and managing that and his sort of mysterious work and all that, I see that anyway.
I think of Stas as one of the workers. I really do. I feel like Stas was an immigrant. He came here, worked like a dog, and made his way. He almost starved to death like, I don't see him as an exploitative overlord or anything.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know. He seems to be pretty, like, he starts off being exploited, and then he's paying these workers minimum wage, and, you know, it's not so...
What workers is he paying minimum wage?
When he goes and moves to Portland, and he's actually managing the workers and all that, and it sounds like it's a really, you know...
Which workers is he managing in Portland?
It's in here. It's when he's talking about how he moved the operations of Kaiser Tech, the computer company or whatever, to Portland.
It's not there. Sorry.
You know, I don't think this interview is working.
So yeah, that's me. I'm shutting off the tape. I'm starting to pack my equipment. I am beating myself up for getting things wrong and for not really establishing, at least in my mind, a rapport and a connection with Alyssa. And Alyssa is looking at me at this point. She's saying, wait, what's going on? I thought we were actually having a good conversation. And it's at this moment that I realize what an utter fool I am. The mistakes that we make and that we incriminate ourselves for are largely in our own head. And so I decided to give this conversation another chance. I threw away my list of notes and questions, and I just talked with Alyssa. And guess what? We got the whole hour. So here's the second part. Enjoy this failed interview that was recovered.
All right. This is actually an unusual experience. So I stopped tape on this interview with Alyssa, and I just told her that I didn't think that we were establishing a rapport. Alyssa, you said, oh my God, I can't believe that we actually did this. And so I decided, instead of actually going ahead and throwing up the Monopoly board, I want to actually talk this out with you, Alyssa, and sort of, and maybe we can tie in the book. I've put my questions away. We're just talking like two regular people. I really enjoyed your book. I want to be clear on this. But you were surprised, and I apparently there was some sort of disconnect in here. And so I guess... I'm trying to see. So we have like almost a two-part interview. The first part is the attempt by me, and I think a lot of it is my own fault in terms of Anyway, what do you think about what just happened?
Okay, so what just happened was you abruptly told me you didn't think the interviewer was working, and I was absolutely shocked because I was just thinking what a pleasure it is to have someone who read the book,
yeah,
has in-depth questions, has smart, thoughtful, really interesting questions. We're having such an interesting conversation, and so I was very surprised.
Okay. Well, I apologize for this, but at the same time, I was compelled to basically say, no, let's record this, let's talk it out,
because
I really enjoyed your book. So, I mean, well, you know, why don't we just talk about, like, you know, regular stuff? So, what's your background? I mean, how did you first start writing?
I wrote as a child. I wrote all the time. I had a little typewriter, a manual typewriter, and I remember typing on it until the black ran out. It was a black and red ribbon, and I would just type until the black ran out, and then I typed until the red ran out, and then I played with the ribbon, and the letters would be half black and half red. I mean, it was really always...
Oh, you're like the typewriter generation.
I was the typewriter generation. I'm 44.
Yeah, okay.
And I really remember, far back as I can remember, I wanted to write.
Why did you want to write exactly? I mean, what was the big need to tell stories? Out of curiosity,
I love to read, and I had a very active fantasy life, and writing really was a way to deepen my fantasies and sort of I had the sense of bringing them to life.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, why did you feel the need to bring your fantasies to life? A lot of kids, they grow up and they keep their fantasies to themselves. And it's interesting because your book deals with this notion of fantasy fulfillment, especially in the second part. Why do you think that that this was something you needed to memorialize or set down? I mean, why was this so important? And why not through drawing? Why not through music? Why not through performance? Or did you do some of those things too?
Well, I don't have any talents in any other way.
You have the writing talent, that's for sure.
But I think I felt good at writing. I mean, I really love to read. I felt I had a facility with language. And I certainly, you know, if I could sing, if I could be a singer-songwriter like Ani DiFranco, I would do it.
Really? Did you try singing at all?
No, I'm just really not a good singer.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I didn't make the chorus in grade school.
You're not like a secret karaoke person or anything?
No. I mean, mean, my kids are the only people who've enjoyed my singing. So,
I'm sure other people do. I'm sure friends do. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure you're a good singer in some way.
Believe me. You just have to trust me on this one. But if I could sing or dance, I would sing or dance. But I can't. This is what I can do.
So writing is... when did you first know that you knew, that you could write, that you can tell stories? I mean, who was your first reader, out of curiosity?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So in middle school, I had this friend, Wendy, and we would write things together. It was this sort of collaboration. I'd write a page, she'd write a page. Yeah. And we'd go back and forth. And that was just incredibly fun.
Sort of like passing notes in class, except telling stories.
Yeah, and it was great because you're not in full control of the story. Somebody else is deciding what happens next. And so I just remember it was just this pleasure. Of course, later it became really hard work. But at first, it was just this pleasure. It was a way to, again, it was a way to bring fantasies to life. And it was just something that it was an element where I was comfortable. Mm-hmm. Being such a passionate reader, I've just felt like naturally able to write, I think.
So when you were passing these notes in class, I'm curious, I mean, was creating fantasies or creating stories, I guess, did this feel more honest than, say, gossiping about, like, what Patty was doing in the back of the class, or who so-and-so was hanging out with, or who had cooties, or something like that? Or,
well, I think even then I remember writing my fantasies. And so there was, in a way, it was a way to really get at that in a way that, you know, that I couldn't talk about explicitly.
Yeah. How naughty were these fantasies at the time? I mean, you did eventually go into erotic fiction and all that.
They definitely had SM elements, you know. They weren't explicitly erotic, not at that age. But again, so if we talk about how, there's lots of things that we invest with eroticism that aren't conventional sex. I mean, so arguably to me, they were always erotic, but they weren't recognizably erotic to other people.
Oh, okay. So, that's interesting. So things that you found erotic, and we were talking in the first part of this interview, which, by the way, thank you for persuading me to actually, you know, give you another chance. I again, very much apologize for that. I'm still quite not entirely certain what happened, but I think I was kind of beating myself over it. But anyway, we're now actually talking, and this is great. So, you know, what things did you find erotic that other people did not, or what qualities did you imbue with eroticism that other people didn't?
Well, I was always fascinated by spanking, fascinated by whipping, fascinated by slavery. Of course, not the kind of, I mean, you know, if you grow up, you're watching Roots, and of course, that's horrible. You know,
Roots. Roots actually triggers spanking eroticism. That's
no,
incredible.
No, no. But it's just the notion of slavery, so, of course. You know, non-consensual slavery is awful.
Yeah.
Just the way non-consensual rape is awful. Like, there's all kinds of, in the SM world, something that's very uncomfortable is people do have slave fantasies. They have Nazi fantasies. They have all kinds of terrible fantasies. And it's disturbing because these certainly aren't things we'd condone in real life.
Yeah.
But we still want to act them out in a fantasy.
So transgression was a very important part of even as a kid growing up, and that's interesting because I wanted to ask you in the book in the second part, Abel's Cain, you have this situation where you address the issue of transgression, but you do so not necessarily through, and I'm going to try not to give it away. You do so not through the people actually, like, you know, revealing their true nature. They actually have to take on another identity, and that to me is extremely interesting because we were talking about noir, and you know what, I think that's what happened with the previous thing was that, like, I was sort of like alarmed that you actually had not read all these things, and I was baffled and bemused that you didn't have any of this kind of, like, that there was no immediate life experience I could track. I think that's why I stopped, Again, I apologize for, and I'm sorry, and I'm glad we're talking now, but I think that's what has kind of threw me off about you.
Well, it's understandable, because now I'm being presented as this noir author, so it's absolutely understandable that you'd expect that I've been steeped in this genre.
Yeah, and that is my failing for even, like, having the chutzpah to basically just say, well, if she's writing noir, she must have read all the noir. And that's a fallacy about me, and that's a fallacy I'm happy to talk about. Why should anybody, why shouldn't people who write noir persuasively. Why they don't necessarily have to have a noir background. What counts is the actual work, and what counts is what people take away with it. Megan Abbott, as I was saying earlier, noir expert. She saw it as a noir, and she ascribed all sorts of things to it and I did too. And I guess that's probably why I just kind of freaked out.
I see it as accidental noir. I mean, So again, if I did set out to be a noir writer and I didn't want to read the noir masters, that would be, I think, you know, that would be really regrettable.
Yeah.
But what happened was, as you pointed out, it's like there were all these elements that noir was a natural vehicle. And until Charles handed me this opportunity and said, write this noir story for me, I set out explicitly to write, you know, something for Hard Case Crime at that point when I wrote Abel's Cain. And so it was just this welcome vehicle for these elements that were just inherently noirish. And if, you know, I loved writing this. Like, I feel very, I love being in this alternate realm at this point, and I would love to read those people now.
Would you say that you've lived a life where you sort of accidentally walked into some alternative realm and had the kind of innate expertise where you kind of figured things out? Maybe like, oh, well, I'm working this particular area, and I happen to have, just by sheer intuition, I happen to also know what other people have done before. Is that kind of like how your life is
rolled? Well, I think if you grow up with these sort of erotic longings that aren't mainstream, then this huge part of your identity is this alternate realm. And something that thrilled me about the SM community is, I mean, I'd go to these SM events.
Yeah.
SM folks would take over a hotel. And, you know, you'd go down to a party in the evening, and there'd be like, just I'll give you one flash, one scene. There's two men who are dominant men, and they're maybe playing chess. And then seated at their feet are their female slaves. And or maybe they're kneeling, and they're on leashes, and they're dresses are open to the waist, and the men are maybe casually every now and then stroking their hair. It's this alternate world. Everyone's decided to live by these rules for this weekend and just take over the space. The outside world goes away. And I think there's so many subcultures like that. You know, I love subcultures as a rule. They thrill me. You know, I get a huge kick out of people. When I was in high school, there was something called the SCA, the Society for Creative.
Oh, yeah, Scott. Yeah, I know them. I know. I was in Bay. I grew up in the Bay Area, so I was very familiar with Ren Faire and that stuff. Yeah.
So I was never an SCA type, but I knew a lot of people who were, and I loved the idea that these people go off to a war, and they fight, and it's dangerous, and for the duration of those weeks, they're in a medieval world, you know, and they're speaking. They're wearing medieval garb, and they're speaking in their medieval dialect, and they've created their own world, and they've stepped inside it. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think there's so many different examples you can give of that. But just when you're a BDSMer, I think you look around. Other people have radar. I mean, I have radar. So I remember being in a
radar. Scott-ar.
I would go. I remember being in a shoe store, and there was a man, a shoe salesman, and the way he was kneeling in front of a woman. I just looked at him and I understood in a flash he had taken that job for the opportunity to kneel in front of dozens of women every hour.
Yeah.
And there were other shoe salesmen and I didn't get that feeling from them. I just looked at him and I knew, and that's the kind of radar I walk around with. And I think there is an alternate world. There's an understanding and there's a radar that we have.
I think it's so you've had sort of this subconscious instinct to perhaps be become gravitated towards you've tended to gravitate towards like unfettered or libertine types who aren't afraid to just essentially express who they are, much like this conversation. I threw my questions aside. Now this is greatly improved. Thank you. You know, that this is actually...
I had never been aware it was bad. I'm sorry.
No. I think what it real ultimately, I think it was just my own sort of weird... I don't think I've ever interviewed a writer who... had not read anything and just had somehow created this entire thing. This just did not compute for me, and I think what happened is my damn brain just decided to perform a...
You were just taken aback.
Yeah, I got the blue screen of death or something, you know. But I wanted to go back to this issue of, like, you've had this instinct to be drawn to kind of libertine types. I mean, have you had scenarios in your life where you've just walked into situations that where people were too controlled and it just didn't work out for you or something like that? Or
too controlled?
Like people were too restrained in the way that they acted or behaved, that this just kind of set you down a wrong track in life? I mean, what do you think? You've pretty much
constantly been around libertine types, or what?
No, I mean, I think that there are definitely environments like corporate America, or at least the surface of corporate America, because like you go to these, sometimes you go to these corporate parties and people have had a few drinks and, you know, I always think there's layers, you know, there's something's always lying beneath, no matter how straight the atmosphere. But I get frustrated even when I'm talking to a person. And I mean, I don't like small talk. It's just maybe it's a failing of mine. Like, I don't want to talk about the weather, or I don't want to talk about safe things. Like, I'll be talking with someone. Within minutes, I want to ask real questions. I want to find out, you know, inappropriate questions. I want to...
We'll talk inappropriately here. There's no boundaries here.
And so that tension surfaces for me whenever I feel that I can't really get at what's going on.
Yeah.
We can't confront something that's really happening.
When did you first know that, like, small talk, talking about politics politics is not small talk. You don't talk about religion and politics, as they say, but weather or, hey, how you doing? I mean, when did you first know that this was a vernacular or a conversational stream that you had to resist?
When did I become consciously provocative? Maybe.
When did you know you were provocative?
I guess... Eighth grade, maybe, it was when I was became conscious of feeling like wanted to shake things. I had the desire to shake things up.
Yeah,
wanted to be different. You know,
when did it first get you into trouble? This impulse.
Well, I mean, it depends on your definition of trouble. I definitely, in high school, you know, I dated someone who was definitely off the, you know, not a mainstream type, and people had a lot of resistance to him. You know, he was expelled from school and, you know, he had lots of conflicts.
Did you expect to be expelled from school at any point?
No. I was a good student.
You were a good person, basically.
I was a good student.
Good student. a bad person, a good student?
You know, I wouldn't identify myself as a good person necessarily. I try very hard to be a good person.
Yeah.
But I feel like I've known really good people, and I don't think, you know, I wouldn't compare myself to those very, very good people.
Have you ever ascribed any kind of, I guess, morality to being provocative or anything like that? Or have you become aware of morality through being provocative?
I think that there's a moral imperative to be provocative if it's what's, like, so I just did a piece for Huffington Post about the 7 most controversial erotic novels of all time, and I was really struck by the idea that, you know, I mean, we writers like to moan about how hard the writing life is, and there are lots of hardships, but we're not facing the kind of hardships that these people faced, where they were censored and their books were banned and burned, and in some cases they were imprisoned, and their publishers faced criminal charges, and even booksellers faced criminal charges. And these were people who broke ground for us and took the hit for us. And so I think what they did I think they had a lot of moral fortitude to do what they did, to write what they had to write, and to, you know, talk about, it's the writer's job to talk about what other people don't want to talk about.
Yeah. When did you know that this became part of an obligation of being a writer to talk about what other people didn't talk about? I mean, did you just sort of learn by example or just kind of do it?
I think I noticed that the work I was drawn to tended to be confessional, tended to really tell the terrible truth about something or other in a way that wasn't safe for the author. And I think that, like, if you're not giving something up, if you're not, you know, then I think that it's a measure of a writer's success how candid they're willing to be and how much they're willing to give up and the risk they're willing to take.
What do you think the most candid or riskiest thing you've ever written is? Or you've
something
ever
that I've ever read?
Yeah. Or written? No, written, actually.
Oh, written? Well, you know, to some extent, I try to do that in everything I write to some extent. This is a pretty, I feel like I give a lot up in this book, you know, talking about, you know, I talk a lot about my own marriage.
Yeah.
And it's called Secret Lives of Married Women. So, I mean, I really had to wrestle with the notion of, I mean, I think anyone in a marriage, there's always a tension between loyalty to the unit and loyalty to yourself. And,
loyalty to the unit sounds so. It actually sounds very much like, you know, polyamory, primaries and secondaries and all that. Yeah.
But there's a loyalty to the marital unit, to the couple.
Yeah.
And then there's loyalty to yourself, and those two can be at odds. And every couple has to negotiate with this.
Yeah.
And it made me think about, like, to what extent are secrets, there's as many kind of marriages as there are couples. Like, there's no one way to be married, and I've met a lot of different people with a lot of different arrangements, and there are people who say they have no secrets, and I just, it's hard for me to believe, ever.
Yeah.
They don't have to be huge, destructive, deceptive secrets. Like, they don't have to be an ongoing, it doesn't have to be a malicious, ongoing deception, but I think everyone has secrets.
Yeah.
Like, you can never truly, fully know another human being.
Well, what's interesting is the characters in your book, they're looking at their husbands, and they're trying to find some quality about them that is transgressive, or that they're willing to actually become transgressive in relation to that act. And, I'm wondering if you feel that this ties into what we're talking about, that the stability of the unit, the idea that... knowing someone means accepting another person's transgressions and also being willing to transgress yourself in order to get to know them or to become more intimate with them. This goes also back to the idea of elastic intimacy. But, do you think that that most marriages that last are really built around transgressive behavior?
I think that most marriages that last have inherent permissions built in that just, like, whatever... the individual absolutely needs for the welfare of their soul to use a really sort of overwrought phrase, but whatever that individual must do, I think if their partner isn't letting them do that thing, then on some level it's not going to be a fulfilling union.
Yeah.
Even if they don't get divorced, it's not going to be the partnership that we want.
Well, what you're exploring, the truths of marriage in fiction, how do you tell your husband about this? How do you tell him, especially when there are parallels? You have to, I guess, kind of keep it secret at first because you're still working it out and it's still building. But, how do you go back to your husband and say, well, this is kind of about us, but not really? Is your husband pretty understanding of that? Or?
Well, so one thing that I'm most grateful for in my life is that my husband is extremely permissive in the ways that I need, mm-hmm. So he never tries to put a limit on anything I can write. He says, you write what you need to write. And he reads what I write. I showed him the story and he absolutely loved the first story because of and in spite of everything in it.
Yeah.
I think he really gets me. And,
that's good.
And I think he's secure in the relationship. Mm-hmm. So, I think he can, he's secure enough to live with, going beneath the facade.
Yeah. Well, learning about someone, being more curious, being more willing to grow deeper is really, I think, a part of what makes successful relationships work. And does fiction give you the courage to, I suppose, grow deeper with your husband, grow deeper with friends, that kind of thing at all? Or is it really just a way of marking territory or marking truths?
I think that, I feel the writers, even if I haven't met a writer, like we've talked about Alice Munro.
Yeah.
I've never met Alice Munro. I feel so, understood and forgiven. And like her writing has made me feel less alone in the world.
Yeah.
I think that... it's interesting. Like once I published Meeting the Master, I cannot tell you the number of people that contacted me privately to tell me, I'll tell you this, something that nobody else knows.
Oh, yes.
I've always had this or that, they've had some kind of urge in the direction of BDSM or, and they tell me that.
Yeah.
And they're people that you wouldn't have the slightest idea, otherwise.
Well, this is one of the unexpected side effects of being a novelist. And in fact, the novelist is probably going to learn more about people's secrets than the journalist because they trust you. How do you deal with the rise in trust where people tell you things, especially when you write about, dangerous subjects or you're provocative, whether accidentally or deliberately? How do you deal with the morality of taking other people's secrets in and having them confide in you?
Almost every conversation I've had where somebody's confessing to me, I've done probably thousands of interviews,
yeah,
just informal interviews, and people know I'm a writer. And I think that if they're telling me something, they're okay with telling me. I'm not going to pretend it's never, I'm not going to pretend that people have never regretted telling me things and wanted me, after giving me material, wanted to take the material back in some way. I think every single writer faces that at some point. But for the most part, people walk in and they're aware that they're talking to a writer. And fiction is a great vehicle because it's fiction. You know? And so again, there's a lot that's drawn from real life in my book, but there's, and this is true in everything I write, there's stuff that's just completely made up. So there's no way to just read something I've written and say this happened, and now I know something about this character that I didn't before, because you can't unequivocally know.
Yeah. Do some of the more outlandish inventions, the imaginative scenes come easier to you than the stuff that is closer to home, or?
God, it's difficult to answer that. Probably what's closer to home comes more easily. I mean, sheer invention is a feat, a feat in itself that, you know, I'm really in awe of people who just make up every single thing.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of those people. but I always do think, even in those cases, there's an emotional truth that's coming from their own lives, their own experiences.
Well, that is actually a very good place to end. Believe it or not, we've been talking for 50 minutes, and we have managed to salvage a conversation that I deemed in the audio will tell. I thank you, my apologies, but thank you very much for sticking it out with me, and this has actually been an unanticipated experiment for me, and I really enjoyed your book, and thank you very much for having the time.
Well, this is absolutely great for me.
Fantastic. All right. Great. Our hearts and home are soft and glistening. We started playing house too soon, it seems. Our sweetest furnishings are split.